Wrestling match.
Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday already, March 19th, and we are here to continue our public hearing on House Bill 5042, the Oregon Health Sciences University. And we actually will be taking public testimony today, and I might just mention that there's a sign-up sheet on the table by the door. People that are from the public that are wishing to testify, we would very much appreciate if you would sign up so that we can call you up and make sure that everyone gets included in the process. The agency, or Oregon Health and Sciences University, will be continuing and finishing up the presentation today. So I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5042 and have the agency come forward and finish the presentation. Good morning. Good morning.
Let me start. For the record, I'm Peter Kohler, OHSU, and I will turn the beginning of the program over to Dr. Halleck.
For the record, I'm Leslie Halleck, Provost at OHSU. And the first thing I wanted to do was just orient you to some of the new paper that's appeared before you, and I apologize for the stream. There are three things that you have. There's a single page and then a clump of pages that are three-hole punched. And those are a continuation of the slide presentations. They should just go behind the material under tab 3, and they may already have been put there for you. I'm not certain of that. No.
The first tab 3?
Let me just verify.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm getting committees confused. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Okay. That's my other committee that has two tabs.
It's just one tab 3, I think.
We haven't had our full allotment of caffeine yet. So
no.
I understand.
Thank you very much.
And the other document that you've received is not three-hole punched, and it is a series of questions that we heard them yesterday and responses to those questions. We will touch upon some of those in the course of the presentation, but obviously would be happy to elaborate if there's still interest. We weren't planning to go through in detail each of those questions, but would be happy to address them. Would you like to say anything about the margin and reserve questions, just by way of overview, Pete?
Yes, I'd be happy. Let me touch on the need to have some margin and why our board is concerned, and the importance of maintaining some margin to have a credit rating so we can go to the bond market. Again, that access to capital is key to our staying competitive and being able to help ourselves, essentially help the state. We need a certain number of days of cash on hand. If you look at the questions that you have before you, this is sort of a lot of that is covered under the second question there. But we definitely need reserves to be maintained for contingencies. One of the things that's happening in the whole healthcare area is that payers, insurers, are delaying their payments quite a large time now. So the ability to collect is taking longer. It is not just the private payers, it is the public payers as well. For example, the state of Oregon, which is supposed to pay us $11 million a quarter, now that we've been shifted onto the MUPL money at the request of the state, has not paid us for January.
They just did.
Okay.
Oh,
they just paid us for January. and took a bite out of it along the way. So,
Madam, I might point out that our inability to maintain a bond rating and our inability to maintain a cash flow, and fact, we borrow to maintain a cash flow, is something not unique to OHSU.
Well, the fact that we bonded to maintain a cash flow.
Don't make me feel worse.
Cash the check soon.
I hope it's an electronic transfer. And we're still worried about the last quarter, which will be due here shortly. So, you know, this is a reason why we need to have reserves so we can make payroll and do all those other things. As academic health centers go, we're in only fair shape. Many academic health centers over the past 5 years or so have actually sold off their hospitals as a way to try to keep their expenses down. Now, if managed well, a clinical program should actually give you a bottom line, a net margin, rather than cost you money. But this just, I think, shows how difficult it is to run a program when, as in Oregon and other states, the public hospitals tend to have a very high proportion of poor people coming there. About 48% of all the public patients, namely Medicare and non-sponsored, in the country are seen at academic health centers, which represent about 3% of all the hospitals in the country. So, again, this is not unusual in Oregon. That larger share of public patients is something that we anticipate. I'll stop at that point, so I'll cover some other things later.
Let me just draw your attention to three other questions that are answered in here, and then a couple that I'll answer in the course of finishing the educational mission. On the second page of the Q&A sheet, we've talked a little bit about this margin in a slightly different context. What I want to do to try and clarify the various kind of assaults on our budget is indicate to you that today, when I talk about budget impacts, I will only be talking about the impacts that are a result of state reductions and Medicaid reimbursement streams where we indicate that that's the case, not about any improvements in terms of margins. So those will not be part of any of the material I'm presenting. And so none of the impacts you're seeing are due to any margin adjustments. Just wanted to make sure that was clear. Those are other things we may end up having to do if the conditions worsen, but not because of the state appropriation. The other thing I wanted to mention is that in the last question on the second page, this takes us back to the question raised by Representative Bates, which has to do with pursuing the Medicaid match and reimbursement revenue, optimizing that in every way possible. And I just wanted to mention, and Mr. Bender may already have done that, that we prepared a pretty lengthy document, which we gave to Mr. Bender, Mr. Britton, the OMAP analyst, and Ms. Parker, the executive branch analyst, that has the lawyer's report. It has the impact of those sorts of matches. So there's a lot of detail in that, and we'd be happy to share that in the discussion with you and Representative Bates and Aaron Crane if you want more information. So there's lots of detail there that you might be interested in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be looking at that with you. We won't take up committee time.
Right.
It's important.
Okay. Let me just add, if I could, as I mentioned to you, I think after the meeting earlier, and we're sorry this didn't come up yesterday during the testimony, we have actually engaged a lawyer named Gage, who is supposed to be the country's expert on how to make sure you get as much federal money back as is appropriate and legally possible to do. He is advising us on this, and we're looking for ways, because we are the only public hospital in the state, to match our revenues, which may be more than the state, but others as well, in such a way that more money could be brought across. The best bet is still the old MUPL money, which is phasing out, and it gets lost month by month. As every month goes by, a month's worth of eligibility is lost. So there's a time-limited factor there, and if we don't move quickly enough, we will get a whole lot less than if we can move more rapidly.
The other material, and I apologize that it isn't tabbed and a little easier to digest, we wanted to bring it back today, and so it sort of came together during the night. But there's some material in there on the recruitment strategies to enhance diversity, and I'll touch on those during my presentation. And then at the back is quite a bit of detail on the federally qualified health centers. I apologize that these aren't tabbed, but there's a bulleted page and a quarter that describes kind of at a high level the process for obtaining this designation and what some of the criteria are and what some of the aspects of that program would be. There's also the letter of intent, which we learned when we went back, literally went out yesterday, and that lengthy letter of intent is there with the detail in terms of our basic declaration that this is the direction we would like to pursue to the federal government, and then some more detailed page on how the assistance need is documented. So that's the material in front of you.
Excuse me, Representative March has a question.
Yeah, I just the material in front of us, I just wanted to clarify on page 3 of the stapled handout, and there's always some confusion about what's the standard population and what is the plus population. The plus population is actually the categorically required population, mandatory, and the standard is the optional. population that we cover.
It's the other way, I think.
It is. No,
Representative Marsh is absolutely correct. It sounds crazy.
It sounds crazy, but
OHP plus is the mandatory population.
Mandatory, yeah.
The mandatory categorical population for Medicaid. OHP standard, which seems contradictory in terms, and I've had trouble with this too, is the expansion population. Okay.
So you're referring here then to the standard population, that 25% is standard, the rest are categorically eligible.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's what I thought you were saying, because I got the impression that you were most of the people that came were categorically eligible for Medicaid.
Right. And I apologize, it's the fault of the scribe and not the sender of the information. So
that's just very confusing. It shouldn't be that way.
Right. Well, what we would like to do next is to take up where we left off on the educational mission, and I'll answer a couple of questions very quickly on dentistry, and then we'll go into medicine and nursing and talk about the rest of the educational missions and a little bit about our budget model, and then we'll turn to President Kohler to talk about the Oregon opportunity and some of the implications of the discussion we had the first day in terms of the funding. I just wanted to bring, in response to Representative Bates' question about the looming shortage in dentistry, a little bit of data. The average wage of a dentist in Oregon turns out to be $118,000. So I was surprised by that also, but that's at least according to the Oregon state data. That's what they have posted. Anyway, I understand.
I was hoping you would.
Where did they get that data?
I have no idea. It's the employment agency. So it's a state agency, but I really don't know. I just pulled it down last night from their internet.
And I just a little along the lines I think you're going, our ophthalmologists now think dentistry might be the best thing to go into. And it used to always be ophthalmology. So.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I'm drawing my data from maybe 10 or 15 dentists. Okay, that is not an adequate sample. And these are general dentists in a small area. It's not 118,000.
That certainly our impression as well. We were assuming, as you and I discussed after the meeting yesterday, that it was in a higher range than that. That was just the official posted. Now, we have another data point that's kind of interesting, and that is that from an individual who was the financial officer of our dental school, he has now a business brokering dental practices, essentially assisting their sale after retirement. And what he tells us is that the average practice grosses $650,000 a year and has 4.4 people in it. Now, of course, there's overhead and cost of the practice as well, but it's just another figure in terms of those are really the only two data points we had. What I really wanted to do here was just
I think that the income information for dentists kind of begs the question about why the tuition is so low.
Right.
So I would think that in work session that would be an issue that we would want to take up.
And you'll see that our strategies are very much addressing that and where we stand. What I wanted to mention just...
All of the map here. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I feel a little scattered this morning. At least I am. Are we going to talk about where we left off yesterday about tuition at the medical school and dentistry school and the rest of it, or is that...
We are.
What's your plan?
My plan is to take up where we left off in the slides, which is right at the end of the dental section and just before the medical section, and that would be...
In tab... The chair
it's in
would,
tab 3.
Got it. The chair would ask the committee members to recognize that we do have public testimony scheduled for today also, and to be mindful of the fact that we will need to leave enough time for the people that sign up to come before us and testify.
Page 23 under tab 3, right in the middle of the page, we were talking about dental tuition, and we finished dentistry, and we were about to start medicine. And the only thing I wanted to do in dentistry, unless you have further questions, was to revisit the shortage question that was asked, because we do have national, fairly recent, last summer, national data on that's pertinent. One of the interesting phenomena in dentistry is that the applicant pool fluctuates quite a bit over time, and the trend, as you can see from this graph over the last 4 or 5 years, is downward. We have fortunately not experienced this. Our applicant pool, as you saw yesterday, is flat at least, if not over 5 years going up. So far, because of the quality of the program, we've been able to sustain the applicant pool. But nationally, this is a great concern. Minority applications in particular have declined over the last 5 years very sharply in the dental arena, and that's another very strong national concern. This is the demographic that really addresses your point in terms of the projection over the next decade or two of dentists based on the age of the dentists in the country. And so the concern is that if the production rate holds as it is today in terms of the dental schools that are open, we're facing a decline in the dentists per 100,000, and it is felt anyway by the dental community that this will create a severe shortage. And if you look out further, it's actually more alarming unless something's done to intervene in the production. The blue lines that go over to the left just show a very sharp decrease. Now, that's a long projection, and you have to be a little bit dubious when anything is projected that far out. But just based on the population demographics, the age of the dentists, the age of the applicants, and the applicant pool, it is a concern, and we are very mindful of the desire to actually increase our class size, especially since we're surrounded by a half dozen states with no dental schools.
Did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could. I'm just going to make a quick comment here and then and not ask a lot of questions because of time constraints. I'd like to point out that from what I can read and putting these different pages together, that it looks like it costs about $55,000 a year to train a dentist. The tuition is about $8,000. About 30% of the students are non-residents of the state of Oregon. And according to another chart I saw, 25% of the cost of training those students is borne by the taxpayers of Oregon. And that's the figure I saw.
Right.
And so we're subsidizing a school that produces people that make a very good living in an area where we have a huge shortage in the state. I can't get low-income Oregonians into a dentist because they won't take them. And I end up covering their practices nights and weekends when they have dental problems about half the time. So I'm not a real happy camper about this, and I'll just be upfront with you about it. We need to expand the school, need a new building, and I don't see a discussion going in that direction of expanding the school, raising tuition to where these people who, like I did, paid for my education, are going to go out and make a good living and work hard. But we need more dentists. We need more responsibility, I think, from the dental community. And I'll leave it there.
One of the things that you'll see when we talk about the model is that actually the way we allocate the state dollars is when we allocate them, we really consider them only applying to residents. For your information, we also did a comparison in the appendices to show what it would look like if you just applied them evenly to all, just so you could see how the numbers play out. But the way you look at that model is just a question of how you consider the state dollars contributing to the budget. And if you apply them all to residents, which is certainly how we think about it and how we adjust non-resident tuition, they still do not cover the full cost of the resident dental students, as you'll see. We'll come to that in just a minute, if I could kind of beg your indulgence. And we absolutely will increase tuition. In the last years, again, you'll see when we talk about the budget impacts, we increased it 15% and 20% respectively for resident and non-resident tuition. So I completely agree. The market can bear a little more. We're in the second quartile. We could easily push to the top because of the quality of the school. And this last adjustment and the one proposed for next year will take us to the top of public dental school tuitions.
General. Whoops.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to shift to medicine. I'm going to touch pretty lightly on medicine unless there are questions. The materials in your book, and in the interest of time, I want to make sure that we have some time for nursing and the budget model and the Oregon opportunity. The point I want to make in medicine is that the percent of state support is relatively modest in the school, but it's not a small amount of money because the school is very large. So the percentages can be a little deceiving. It's a critical element of leverage, and it really reimburses the faculty for the time they spend teaching. So it's a critical piece of their time. The rest they earn by clinical care or research. This helps them teach on top of that. With the, other than the teaching, they raise essentially their revenue to pay their own salaries. It's changed a lot. This is when the school first started, and I thought you might enjoy seeing how it started on the Hill, and now the medical school looks more like this. And has made incredible progress in terms of its national reputation. We've been ranked in the top three, first, second, and third in different years in primary care in the country. So the primary care is a very keen strength of the medical school. The residency programs, those training programs after the MD is obtained, are also ranked very highly, particularly in the ones I've mentioned here, family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics as well, where I ran out of room to include them all. Important metric. We talked about applicant pools yesterday. We have over 2,600 applications for 96 slots. We took 100 this year. So there's a lot of applicant pressure, very highly qualified pool, a lot of heartbreak, frankly, in qualified applicants who don't get in. But we have a superb pool. Our pool increased 30% over the last 5 years. The national pool declined 30% over the last 5 years. That's the same story I just told for dentistry. So we're competing effectively in the applicant pool for qualified candidates. The other measure, and I mentioned this briefly yesterday, is really how effectively our students match into the residency programs of their choice. And this last year we had 100%. That's an extremely rare thing across the country. Schools typically have a handful of students that have to be sort of manually placed. Every one of them matched into one of their top choices, so we were very pleased with that. The data is in here that supports all the things I just said in terms of entering test scores relative to the national average, entering GPAs, and so on. So I won't belabor this. The tuition, just to touch on the tuition subject, and you'll see again when we talk about reduction impacts, last year we increased resident medical tuition 25% as a result of the reduction in the last legislative session. So that's exactly the direction we're taking, is we are already at the top of public medical schools in the top five. We haven't seen the data yet because it's not in yet for this year. We think we're top, but we're certainly in the top five before any adjustments that would result going forward from the legislative session. So we're at the top of the public market. We're kind of at the bottom of the private market. We're right on that interface is where we sit in terms of tuition.
I have a feeling you have a comment on
that. Just real quickly, I mean, I don't want to take up a lot of time. I'd like to see the figures for the private market, too.
Certainly.
I would point out that many of us were paying tuition higher than that 25 years ago when we went to medical school.
The private market, I can tell you, because we're struggling with that in the non-resident case, because the private market's actually around 30. It's not as high as you might think, or you probably know that, but we're above the private market in non-resident tuition, and that makes it very hard to compete. A place where that becomes a problem is when we're trying to compete for very bright students who are sought after. Minority students tend to be in that category. And very often they're recruited effectively to another institution. Some of that's a better financial aid package. Some of it is actually lower private tuition, oddly enough. And 30 is kind of the ballpark for those numbers. What I'd like to do is go on to nursing now and talk just a little bit about that. I think you've probably heard about the looming nursing shortage. I want you to understand just a little bit about why that's occurring and what we're doing about it. This, again, is an interesting comparison. In the previous biennium, the state supported 40% of the revenue budget, the budgeted revenue for the School of Nursing. In 2003, that number is 29%. So we're struggling here, but we have a remarkable set of faculty and terrific leadership in Dean Kate Potempa, and they've actually been able to make much more efficient their program. So we've managed to do pretty well. We've actually increased our class size this year in spite of some of the reductions. They've also begun to rise rather rapidly on the national ranks in research and in the quality of their programs, and here are just a few of those metrics. Their master's programs are in the top 10, every one of them, across the country, and they have been for the last decade. We moved from 9th to 8th to 7th, and we're hovering right around 8th in our research funding with respect to the NIH, and all of the specialty programs are ranked very highly again. We are very well known for our ability to deliver distance ed, and those we do on a self-support basis, we call it, so we don't subsidize those, and actually they're sought after from surrounding states. The Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, which accredits us, uses our graduate, our PhD program in nursing as the, they call it the gold standard for a distance ed delivery program. So we're very proud of that. Really began in the early 90s when the state system of higher ed decided that nursing ought to be consolidated under our dean. And we had to, in one summer, revise the curriculum to deliver it all over the state. And those faculty who are on 9-month appointments between June and September revised that curriculum and accomplished that task. So it's a, they're sort of leading the way, and we like to rib the medical faculty that the nursing faculty are really the experts in technology and distance ed here. You can look at this map, and I've actually included a little more I know it's probably a bad thing to say, but a colored version of it in your notebook because it's easier to get the information off of it. But you can see the kinds of programs that we have all over the state in nursing. I want to say a little bit about the shortage and then come back to those programs that are all over the state. This is state employment data and projections. The red line is what the projected need over the next decade in nursing is thought to be, according to the state economic the employment department. The blue line is what we project will happen in terms of nursing production, that is graduates, if we do nothing today. If no programs are cut, no programs are expanded, we just keep doing what we're doing, we are clearly going in the wrong direction. Why is this? Well, mainly it's the baby boomer population in nursing. The average age of nurses 20 years ago was 29. It is now 50. So we have an aging nursing population, and we have a constant or even declining a little bit in production rate. The green line is what would happen if every program in the state, all 14 community college programs, all of our programs all over the state, and the private programs all doubled. So I think that gives you a flavor for the magnitude of this challenge. What we are doing to try and address that challenge is, first of all, trying to expand our class size with no additional revenue. How do you do that? Well, all over the country, applicant pools are barely making the admissions that are required for the size of the programs. We have not had that problem. We have an applicant pool that exceeds what we need to recruit qualified students. Our GPAs, if you look through the material, continue to be high. We do not have a problem with applicants. We have plenty of those. We certainly don't have a problem with jobs. This is an economic development dream. The jobs are there. So it's relatively easy in this state, partly because of the quality of the program, to recruit nurses in. We have a problem in this state in capacity, and we simply don't have the capacity right now. One of the things we're doing is really playing a leadership role across the country in the teaching model. The teaching model is kind of old-fashioned. It's kind of one-on-one apprenticeship-style teaching, really. And increasingly, nursing programs in our arena in the state are experimenting with simulation models, with computerized applications that help teach the students, at least in their first year, more efficiently than this clinical one-on-one teaching. And so what we've done is we've gone, and they're really remarkably sophisticated. 10 years ago, they were not, and they weren't all that useful. But now, what you can do, we have a sim lab we're just building that can simulate an ICU unit, a med-surg bed, medevac helicopter, home health unit bay. It can be modified to be any of those things and teach nurses how to deliver care in that. And they can practice on these computerized mannequins without hurting them. So it's especially nice. And then what we do is we build this curriculum such that at the end of it they have what's called an intensive experience. They're put into a health system. Once they're done and therefore kind of useful, in the health system. And our experience has been when we have these intensive immersion experience elements at the end of the curriculum, that these students are immediately hired into the health system where they're doing their internship. And the reason for that is, A, they're pretty qualified when they get there, but B, by the end of that experience training, they also know the system itself, you know, where you go to make prescriptions come to the bedside. How do the systems integrate? And that's a hard thing to learn. And when you hire a brand new nurse graduate, they don't know any of that in the context of that particular hospital. So this model is both more efficient because when they land on the job, they're ready to go, and it's more efficient from a faculty to student ratio. So one of the things we're trying to do without additional resources is ramp up our capacity using some of these experimental models.
Senator Mesmer.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I'm on the same basis as what we're being presented here. Are you including the capacity of the community colleges or satellite campuses as well when you look at the demand and the growth?
Absolutely. And that's a wonderful question because it's a perfect segue to what's actually happening in the state. There's a wonderful consortium that's emerged, and it's being watched all over the country because it's the most cooperative thing in nursing education anywhere. It includes all the leadership of every community college program, and that number, that green line in the middle, assumes they all double too, which, of course, they're struggling with, as you well know, with the same kinds of budget constraints. But the nursing leadership of all the community colleges, of all the programs at OHSU all over the state, and of the privates have formed a nursing leadership coalition, a council they call it, and they are developing articulated models where we would deliver education on the community college campuses using community college faculty and it ramping up their capacity as well as ours. So it's really a much more efficient way to do business than sort of competing with one another. But the other thing that's probably even a more immediate acute crisis is the faculty for those community college programs. We have one that probably can't stay open as a result of not being able to recruit faculty. So that would be the first place we would put faculty. So one of the things that we're going to have to do is graduate more teachers to help staff up those community colleges. But it's as an academic officer, this is a dream come true because we have programs working together that historically have not worked well together, frankly, and it's a wonderful story to tell. And it isn't we're going to do this whether in spite of the budget context, we'll find a way to do this. It's just a question of how rapidly we can really ramp it up. And obviously we're seeking support everywhere we can, including federal initiatives to do so. Anything else you'd like to hear on nursing in the context of our schedule here? I could talk for hours, but I know I'm not supposed to. I want to say a word about Allied Health because there was some concern yesterday about program closures, and it's certainly something of great concern to us as well. If you look at Allied Health programs here, you can see that the orange component of their revenue, the state component, has been cut in half, in essence. And the reason for that is severalfold. One is that we're not the only provider of allied health education in the state. There are other providers in some cases. The other is that we've managed to form these wonderful partnerships to save the most critical of them. The medical technology program is a great example. There used to be 13 medical technology programs west of the Mississippi, and right now there are 5. So if we were to close ours, it would create quite a crisis here. And so what we've done is we've partnered with the Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls, and you may know they have a campus in the Portland metropolitan area. And they have a fair bit of health oriented programs in Klamath Falls. They have a dental hygiene program. They used to have a medical technology program, and during Measure 5, they transferred those students to us. And we've always had a very cooperative relationship with them. They have imaging programs down there. But where this stuff is needed is in the metropolitan area in terms of the jobs for these folks. So what we've done brought in OIT as a partner in the medical technology program. It's actually still being operated on our campus, but through their budget model using our tuition. So it's one of these interesting hybrids where we had pushed the tuition up to market, and the higher ed system didn't really allow for that. So we were able to kind of capitalize on all the best market practices and build a program that can support itself. So we've been able to sustain that program. In fact, we've been helping them recruit. They do their experiential training all over the the state in the clinical laboratories that exist. And I went through an accreditation visit with these folks in the middle of all this transfer and partnership discussion. Now, you would think if you were being accredited, they would put you on probation until they saw what you were going to do. We had had three-year accreditations. After that visit, because they visited these clinical sites around the state and got such good reports about the quality of the students, they accredited us for 5 years. On the sort of faith and credit that we would continue and find a way. So we were very heartened by that, and this is a real success story, I think, of a response to adversity that has saved the program. And we have a similar story with the paramedic program, which has an additional neat twist, and that is that the third partner in that program is the Tuolity Fire and Rescue Group. They have 130 paramedics. They cared a lot that we not close that program. They have a wonderful new training site. They succeeded in having a bond measure fund this training site. They allow us to train our students there for free. We've formed no rent, beautiful facility. We combined with OIT to administer the program and with their Portland-based faculty. And in exchange, they have two slots, essentially, in the program, which if the students qualify and are admitted, have waived tuition. There tend to be firemen and women who want to become a paramedic and obtain this program. The other thing we've done is we've created halftime options for these people so they can obtain that training. It used to be a full-time block curriculum. Now it has a more flexible curriculum so that working people can go on. So those are two success stories that have found other sources of funding and other arrangements that we were able to preserve. Dental hygiene program isn't quite such a happy story. Dental hygiene is an incredibly expensive program. It takes chairs. It takes a massive facility infrastructure. It's hard for people to start and stop. And we're not the only provider of dental hygiene education in the state. We provided 30% of the graduates in the state. The other 70% come from Portland Community College, Mount Hood Community College, OIT in Klamath Falls, as I mentioned. And those programs are now looking at whether they can enhance their capacity. We have offered to a couple of the privates, actually, who are interested in starting a program to be helpful in any way we can, including letting their students come to our facilities and train with the dental students in that clinic. And that probably will eventually work, but it's been, because of the facility investment that's required up front, it's a difficult thing for an institution, another educational institution, to jump into right away. But there's three or four of them looking at it. In the meantime, those existing programs like OIT and community college programs are all looking at how much capacity do they have. Can they take a second evening class? Can they ramp up to make that gap shorten? The questions about allied health? I just want to mention the physician assistant program because the legislature started this program really with a statute. And it's an odd way to start an academic program, but in the early 90s, there was a little tiny statute that was written to launch the physician assistant program. This is almost entirely a self-sufficient program, and it's risen in quality since we started it. They now have an applicant pool of 420. They had 100% pass rate on their national board exams last year. That's a remarkable accomplishment. They rank in the 92nd percentile nationally in their scores on those exams, and so this is a real success story as well. They have federal funding and tuition that provide most of the resources, and after the budget reductions this year, it looks like we'll have only $35,000 of state general fund per year in that program, and the rest is all leveraged. So that's been a wonderful story. I have some combination slides. I won't take the time to go over, but if you're interested in sort of comparative GPA between the health professions and pass rates, first-time pass rates on some of their exams, that's all in there. I wanted to spend a few minutes on the question raised yesterday about the diversity of our student body. This is an issue that's been of keen interest to me personally over the last couple of decades at OHSU, and so I take pride in some of the recent accomplishments, but we're certainly not where we want to be. I didn't go back far enough because I really couldn't get into our system beyond the 5 years back last night to show you that and 5 years before this, our numbers were more like 6%, 7%, 8%. So we've risen, and the last 5 years kind of held steady in the face of some real changes in affirmative action and the way you can recruit, which takes a much more aggressive outreach and recruitment strategy, much of which is described in the material I provided. But I want to just give you a little bit of flavor for that recruitment and how we do that. We do this with extensive program. extensive pipeline.
We'll wait until you finish this section, and then she'll have.
Okay, then I pause. The extensive pipeline programs. Now, one of the things I provided in here is the data of the ethnicity breakdown of all of our students for the last 3 years. If you look through, it's an awful chart. It has a gazillion numbers on it. But if you look through it, the bottom line will tell you that the predominant minority represented is are Asians, and that we have trouble recruiting the others, although actually recently we've made some gains in Native American population. In the outreach programs, where we really now, over the last 3 or 4 years, bring students in at a very early age, we start in elementary school, and bring them in and work with them summer after summer and in a continuous manner, we've really begun to build a pool of people who relate to OHSU and come back, and we think are now showing up. In fact, we know are now showing up in our applicant pools. This is just one example. There's two or three in here. You don't have this in your book, but I gave it to you on a separate sheet. One of those I had you insert behind the material. This conference that was held last November had 100 students, 99 students. African American students were 16 in number, 9 Native Americans, 22 Hispanic, 31 Asian, and 8 Caucasian. So it gives you a flavor for the kind of effort that went into recruiting these individuals to come here from a variety of sources. We depend heavily on summer programs, and we have lots of them now, which brings students in for various lengths of time, sometimes a week, sometimes all summer. And these are just examples of them. We call the second one HAMS. The students did that. And these are college students. The CURE Project's actually funded by a supplement to our cancer center and brings in students in high school. And then we have actually the first one we call Yo Science actually brings in elementary age children. All of these students associate with us for one of these experiences, and then we bring them back into subsequent ones as they progress. So I've given you a little bit of the kind of spread of these students so you could see. ODMA is the Office of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs. And one of the things we did in recent years is locate them very centrally. They said they want to be in the heart of everything. Well, we put the new office, which is a lovely new facility, in literally in the middle of our cafeteria. And so it's front and center where all the students see it. And what's beginning to happen, we just opened it, is these students are starting to come up after school in the afternoons to do homework and to get help and tutoring and test-taking skills and so on. So we're really beginning to recruit from a very young age to pull students through the pipeline. This is a passion of some of us because in general, and not just in diversity recruitment, the health and science pipeline is thinner than it's been since Sputnik went up. It's a huge problem in this country in terms of the recruitment of young people into health and science careers. So increasingly, we are starting to do more and more in this area. And there's more material here, but this is kind of the first real, data that shows that some of these are beginning to work. And remember, some of them are only 3 and 4 years old. But we have these students now turning up in our applicant pools. And so now our job is to recruit them and admit them and get them to stay. We don't usually have any problem admitting them. We financial aid packages that keep them is our challenge, and we're really putting together everything from tuition waivers to scholarships in order to do that. And I just draw your attention to an article that was in the Oregonian, and in fact we're really the best player in this arena, and we're pretty proud of what we've accomplished. I'll just mention one other element of diversity and then pause, and that is the gender diversity. And I would say probably our largest challenge here is recruiting men into nursing. We do pretty well at recruiting women into medicine. In fact, our current class coming in the fall looks like it's in the high 50s. It may even be 59% female in medicine, and that's a drift across the country, although we're slightly ahead of the curve there. Dentistry's been more of a challenge. I think we'll hit 40% next fall in terms of admissions. So the last 2 or 3 years, we've really made significant progress there. And in nursing, we're increasingly challenged to recruit men into nursing. I think the shortage will actually help there because it will drive salaries up and it'll make it an attractive field. And I suspect we're going to see some enhanced diversity there. I should probably pause at this point and answer questions.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Not a question, just appreciation for the aggressive efforts that are underway, and also to share some information with you, the governor's racial and ethnic health task force, the governor's racial and ethnic health task force meets this afternoon, and I want you to know that we will be passing on the information that you have provided today about your enhanced efforts to get more diversity into the university. These efforts will be shared.
Thank you very much.
And you can also expect probably to be contacted to come in and make a presentation to the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force.
Well, thank you. We'd love to do that. There's some wonderful things going on, and we're starting to learn what works. I mean, we won't claim to be experts, but we're starting to see what really helps. Other questions?
Further questions or comments? Please proceed.
I have a section in here mostly for your interest on the Oregon Graduate Institute of the School of Science and Engineering, as we all now call OGI. There are no state general fund revenues that flow through their budget, so I won't dwell on it. But I wanted you to know about it, and I gave you some statistics and some feeling for their programs, mainly because it's directly relevant to the Oregon opportunity, in that we've been able to bring together the talent in computer science and engineering with the human genome and genetic kinds of analysis that generate so incredibly much data. I mean, one of the things that has come out of the biology of today is that you need computer science to actually cope with it and ask and answer questions. And what's interesting to me, as someone who was around when molecular biology was emerging, in the 60s, what happened to biology is that physicists got interested in it. And they got interested in it because as it became apparent that DNA was the underlying structure that determined genetics, and the structure of DNA was elucidated, they could ask precise questions. And that's what physicists like to do, and chemists. And so suddenly had physicists becoming virologists and other strange things. And what happened when that occurred is that this new field of molecular biology emerged. And it changed science fundamentally. And today, I think we're on the cusp of exactly the same kind of phenomenon. It's a sea change in how you approach biological questions. And in part, it's going to be by some discipline we haven't even named yet, although all those funny words like genomics and proteomics are the beginning of trying to name them. And they're really grappling with how do you take all the information we now know exists in the human genome, in the code of what makes up a human being or any other entity, and translate it into questions that can help you cure diseases. So by bringing science and engineering into an academic health center, which is a fairly novel thing to do, we've positioned ourselves exactly to tackle those hard questions. So I just wanted to make that point, and we've put some bragging points. I always tease the deans and say, give me your bragging point slides, and we put some of those in here so you can get a sense for the quality, particularly in the database and computer science area of this entity, and I'm going to just flip through them very quickly here. I do want to mention briefly the Area Health Education Centers, because you help fund those, and in fact, if you remember from the Pac-Man diagram, virtually 100% of their support comes from the State General Fund. They were started when President Kohler came to OHSU in 1989, and the way they're structured, they start off on federal funds for 7 years, and then theoretically the state or community is to backfill that and have 7 years to get there. We've been pretty successful in that area. You have funded, in fact, 4 of the 5. We've withdrawn support from one of them because the fifth one wasn't funded, but we've managed to fund it with federal grants, and they've become an independent 501c3 and essentially are funding themselves now, separate from the AHEC program. What the AHECs do is address distribution. That's really the heart of the AHEC. They deal with distribution problems, shortages due to the fact that people aren't moving to the area of need. Wherever the underserved area can be, it can be in a rural area, it can be in an underserved community in the middle of a city. And so here we have altered the distribution. Now, you can't solve all the economic problems of an area with this sort of program. But if you educate students inside you where the need is, they're more apt to settle there. And if it's not rocket science, you bring an 18-year-old to Portland, they don't always go back right away, at least not for a couple of decades sometimes. So we have programs all over the state, and I've given you a map. And in there, which is looks like this, and I think it's kind of toward the end of this first section in your packet, it is also colored because you can't get the information any other way. This combines some of these training sites that are all over the state and how we manage different kind of healthcare learners in these programs. So it gives you a flavor for the web of different kinds of interdisciplinary teams that are training in these sites. And one of the things these centers do, which in three cases are 501c3s themselves with community-based boards, is they'll provide housing for these students while they're training there and other sorts of support. So it's a very powerful program for changing distribution. Since I've already talked about it, I'm not going to talk as much about the educational outreach programs, but I wanted to share just one aspect of them. I asked them to give me some bullets that described kind of their goals and some of their successes, and they put on here as the last goal, obtain external funding, and I thought, well, that isn't exactly a programmatic goal, but it's a very worthy goal, and so I left it on there. And in fact, the point I'd like to make, and I'm going to skip forward one slide, is that we have now $17 million in grant submissions pending from these programs. So our notion here is that outreach programs ought to be self-supporting and funded however we can fund them, and that's the kind of thing that we're doing on these outreach programs. And if you look at that middle slide, it gives you some numbers. I'll just give you one example in the interest of time. We had 4 weeks ago, in the heart of the chaos in the K through 12 system in Portland, when they were talking about strikes, they were talking about shortened school years, we had a science fair kind of outreach workshop for science teachers on a Saturday up on the Markham Hill. We brought in 250 science teachers on their own time, on their own dime. They came in, they spent the day learning about neuroscience. And the reason they did that, and they were incredibly excited, and we piped that to Roseburg and to LeGrand as well, and they ended up going back to their classrooms and preparing their students to come to Brain Awareness Week, which just concluded a week ago at OMSI. And so on their own time, they enhanced their own curriculum with the material we gave them, and they came up and learned, took it back to their students, prepped those students. So when they came to OMSI, they were just hyped. I mean, these students were so excited, and they had all this information, all these questions they were primed to ask, that whole brain awareness activity has become a very powerful tool for science outreach for our science teachers. And I just found it so heartening that these teachers, who were really in the midst of a very difficult period of time, would do that and would come and really enhance their programs. What I have next is a fairly significant transition.
Okay, Dr. Halleck, before we begin a discussion on the student-based budget model, I have a couple of questions. In the instructions that the sub-chairs were given by the co-chairs and that the LFO staffers gave to the agencies, we requested to be supplied with two things. One was a prioritization of your mission as it relates to the general fund, and the other one was a list that went to 30% of the cuts in general fund that you would recommend taking. I don't see those pieces in this presentation anywhere, and I'm wondering if you might tell us where they are.
Yes, and the budget model actually tells you the prioritization, and I'm sorry that isn't clear because there's so many spreadsheets in here, but I'll try and make that very clear. The percent reduction priority I have in here, and I'll show you, and I'm sorry you don't have paper for that, but we'll give it to you this afternoon. I mean, I'll give it to Mr. Bender this afternoon, and he
okay.
can say they are in here.
I want to stress that we will not be going to work session on that budget until these documents are clearly what we're looking for.
Okay. Well, you'll have what we have here this afternoon, and then based on feedback, we can adjust that the next day or two and give them to you.
May I add to your request? It would be helpful. I know there's a page that details the mission of the university, and I don't recall which page it is. But the providing services to the underserved is the last item on that page. And so my first question is that statement of your of the university's missions, is that a prioritized list?
It is not.
It is not. Okay. And then as you're going through this model with us, if you could help me understand the place of the underserved
sure.
in the model, I'll know
right.
surfacing as a priority.
Certainly. Those four missions...
Dr. Hellick, if I might just interject here, that the place that we need to end up as a committee and the place that the full Ways and Means process needs to end up is that we need to have some kind of parallel mechanism across the agencies that we can use to prioritize missions and prioritize cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So we would ask you to work with us very diligently in having Oregon Health and Sciences University's priorities be folded into that grander scheme of things.
Certainly. I hope that'll be a little clearer. It may not be exactly where you want to end up, but in the next couple of days it will be. But I think it'll at least you'll have a sense of that in the next couple of minutes.
Thank you. And let me also just lay another card on the table here that we have a sign-up sheet here with eight or so people on it. So I will be giving you the... checkered flag here probably just shortly after 10 o'clock.
Okay. And I want to be sure and leave a segment for President Kohler to talk about the Oregon opportunity and come back to that as well, if that's all right. Between now and 10 o'clock. The budget-based model, I have included enormous detail in this model in one of the appendices that's addressed. What I've captured here are just a few slides to try and help you understand how we're thinking of this. This is relatively unique in the country to have a complete handle on what our educational mission actually costs us. And one of the reasons we can do that is because our fiscal team has now the ability to program our costs according to mission, according to whether the faculty are educating or doing research or doing clinical care or doing outreach for the underserved. And frankly, we see the state dollars as primarily funding education mission and the underserved mission. We do not see it as funding research or clinical care, which we see as having to earn their own way and generate revenue to do so. I've captured only three degree programs here to give you a sense of their full cost. The methodology for developing that full cost is in the appendices, and I can talk about it when there's time with anyone who wants to. But it basically captures the instructional cost, it captures the facilities cost, the infrastructure, the library, the pieces of that, the percentage of that that supports the educational mission. So it's a full cost at OHSU of educating various kinds of students. And I've listed here the three main health professions, the dental, medical, and nursing undergraduate programs. And it shows that the total cost for those programs are $54,000, $85,000, and $18,000 per year per student. When you look across, if you assume, and this takes us back to Representative Bates' question earlier, if you assume that the state contribution is really only to support residents, if that's your assumption, and that pie chart gives you the total breakout of the whole school, so you can kind of see it as a whole, but if you just look at it that way, you can see that the state bears, it depends on the program, but certainly less than the remaining cost after the tuition. That bottom line, across that bottom line, is the gap that's not funded by tuition, state dollars, or by other sources. And if you look, for example, and we'll see that in just a minute, in some of the programs we're able to obtain training grants in medicine and nursing. In the dental program, we're actually able to use clinic revenue where they practice. If you go to the next page, I've broken out the nursing programs just a little bit more. The appendices break everything out so you can see all kinds of student cohorts. But in nursing, I thought I'd mention it because we were talking about the shortage. And you can see here the both the baccalaureate program, but also the two graduate programs. And the reason I did that is the nurse practitioner and clinical nurse specialist, that middle column, are really advanced practitioners, and there's a tremendous need for them as well. The third column are the teachers, I said, were in such short supply. So we train all of those kinds of people. If you want a prioritization of how we spend state dollars, you just follow the state contribution to each of these. Now, this is on a per-student basis. If you look at, and I want to skip forward three slides to the one that shows you the overall fiscal impact of educational mission. I'll come back to the others if I have time. But I want you to look at this slide because it shows the gap that OHSU funds by revenue it earns. The total cost of the educational mission of the three health professional schools is listed at the top for all students, $18, $47, and $15 million. The state contribution is the next line, and that's for all students in those programs. This is no longer per student, but it gives you a feel for the order of magnitude of dollars that are attributed to the educational mission in those schools. The next line...
Representative Smith has a question.
Sure.
Maybe my timing's off on this. We have concentrated on medicine, nursing, and dentistry.
Right.
There are other needs and shortages in the state with med tech and radiology. Is that going to be talked about at all?
It is in the model, and let me just go forward one more slide, and I think I can make exactly the same set of points. It's just a little bit more complete. If you look at the last column here in Allied Health, you can see it's a less expensive program, but there is a state contribution in there, and we do distribute some state dollars to these programs. We actually almost support them on tuition, and you can see that here, not almost, but the tuition pays half of the cost of this program, and our subsidy and need to help support it is relatively modest. That's because we've rearranged these programs to make them more self-sufficient. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And is it detailed in here how much those programs cost as far as a per-student basis? Am I not looking in the right place?
It is in there, and it's in the appendix. It's actually, it's...
Just tell me where to go, and I won't take up the committee's time.
And I'll be happy to show you, too.
Sure.
It's in Appendix D.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Because, I just want to make a point. As we... as our health needs are obviously going to be growing over the next couple of decades, so will technological advances increase. We're going to need people to understand how to run the machines and do the technology, the computers, all the stuff that I have no idea about. But that I would think that is would be an ongoing need, and as much attention as you've given this, although I understand why you've talked about this, because this is the main core mission of OHSU, but maybe we could just touch on that too.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the programs we've preserved in this Allied Health is the radiation therapy program. And those are the individuals who deliver radiation to a cancer patient, and we've tried to build it in such a way that it's kind of assimilated into the health system. That's where they train. But there's a tremendous need at all hospitals that do radiation therapy. So there's lots of examples, and I'd be happy to share that. I just want to make the point here that we fund these programs however we can. The state contribution is seen here. The tuition is obviously a very major component. We set, and since 95, have consistently set tuition to market. So what that means is we try, it's obviously an educated guesstimate, but we try and push tuition as hard as we can and still maintain the quality of our applicant pool. I think in dentistry we have some elasticity there. We can probably push a little bit harder. We're in the second quartile of public tuitions. We have a very high quality program. I think we can push that in medicine. We probably can push it a little. We're increasingly looking like a private school in both cases. And that's a public policy decision, but it's a viable model. We also obtain clinic revenue and training grants wherever we can, and you can see a little of that. I want to talk a little bit about the reductions, because these are not in there, and these are the paper that we'll try and print before we leave the building and leave with Mr. Bender, and we'll get back to you with more specificity if you would like it. I just recapped here the reductions that we've taken and some of the consequences during the last during current biennium that we're just finishing, so you can see kind of how we adjusted things to accommodate those changes. The $10 million came in the session in 2001, and I'll briefly tell you what we did there. The first special session allocated a cut specifically designated for the hospital, and you heard a little bit about that in the Medicaid reimbursement discussion yesterday. The first year it was implemented was when the MOPL payments were higher, and then they went away, and so that was sustained in the governor's recommended budget. So that's part of the pressure on the reimbursement stream that you heard about in the hospital yesterday. And then the second through the fifth special sessions, there were little chunks that came along that added up to approximately $900,000. And then there's the MUPL payment shortfall that we mentioned earlier, and we're just kind of waiting. We're assuming that will be paid in full, but we just would like to know that it has been. What did we do to accommodate that set of cuts? I've laid these out. I won't dwell on it because that's not the question you're asking going forward. It just sets the backdrop. We pushed tuition very hard. It ranged from 5% in nursing to 25% for resident medical students, partly based on their ability to pay it back, partly based on market. And we also really worked on every reimbursement stream we could find, and we found a couple. In CDRC, we were able to bring Medicare money into funding these kids with special health care needs, and that was very helpful. It looks like we have another opportunity to do that in the next round, and we're obviously pursuing those with or without reductions. That's a good strategy, and I've addressed the rest of these, so I don't want to dwell on them. And there's several others, but what I'd like to do is talk about the various adjustments that we have already placed into our budget process based on the governor's recommended budget, and then I'll go beyond that. In the governor's budget, we've accommodated that reduction, which was about $3 million, by increasing the tuition projections for next year about an average of 6%. As I mentioned, there's a CDRC reimbursement opportunity. We think it's almost $1 million. So we think we don't know if we'll achieve all that, but over time. Again, the clinicians who practice contribute. They generally make about half to two-thirds of their community counterparts. They are contributing 8% of that revenue to the School of Medicine to contribute to the educational mission. So we call that the Medical Education Fund, and that is coming in. That clinical revenue, as it goes up, will actually increase the contribution to the school
as well. Dr. Pollack, we don't have these slides.
You do not. These are the ones I said I would get to him this afternoon. I apologize for that. They came about last night after I was unconnected to the computer printer. And so these are basically revenue strategies and efficiency strategies, and I think they will accommodate the governor's recommended budget without program reductions. There will certainly be a lot of pressure on the hospital system from the Medicaid, but not from the appropriation. As you start digging deeper, as you go through these cuts, and here I've grouped the 2 to 4% range, and they basically are quantitative elements of these qualitative items. So you would go deeper, but you wouldn't change items of reduction going from 2 to 4%. There'd just be more of them. And I'll break that out more specifically if you would like that.
Well, and I would really urge you to work with Mr. Bender on the format that we're asking agencies to bring this information forward in.
Okay. Happy to do that. One important element of that is enhancing the productivity using the nursing models that I described. Basically allows the class sizes to be increased with the same faculty. And the health system revenue opportunities, salary increases are budgeted across the institution. And then a variety of sort of S&S, supplies, basically, and travel and things like that have been reduced. And I'll give those numbers to Mr. Bender. As you go to the 6 to 10%, you go more or less in this order, and there's some choices here, frankly, which involves very deeply cutting into central administration. And I'll give you a couple of examples of the budgets that are coming in as we budget for next year in this range. The library will close in the evenings. It will curtail 187 subscriptions. I mean, I can give you an endless list of very specific items that are contemplated in this Central Administration Service reduction. Some of that will impact the ability to deliver programs in an outreach mode. Some of it will reduce the efficiency, but we don't think any of them are fatal. They're just going to make it a little harder to do business. We're looking again at tuition increases, trying to determine where we can do that. We're trying not to do that in nursing, at least not very much, because the population, we really need to recruit into that population. And again, we're looking at enhancing class sizes. We're actually looking at increasing the number of medical students fairly significantly, and these are right now we're planning for 10 increase next year, 30 the following, 60 the following. We don't know about the fourth year. That we do not have the plan in place for to increase it by that much. We're just looking now at what those costs would be. The dental, until we build a new dental school, really can't go much higher than 5 more because of the limitation of the facility. So that gives you that option. When you get to the 30% level, you really have to talk about a major change in what we are. And the place that you have to look is what is core to sustaining a healthcare system in this state. And that tends to lead you to trying to protect as best you can the medical and nursing schools. And creating a system where the School of Dentistry and the other allied health programs, frankly, are either able to support themselves or not. And we would have to test that, but that's really where 30% takes you. And it probably also, and in the material I submitted in the 30% budget, eliminates or drastically reduces some of the subsidized care in CDRC if they took their share of the appropriation, and the AHEC, some of the outreach programs that are very dependent on state support. That's what you see in that 30% range as you get between 10 and 30.
Okay.
And I think I better stop there and take questions, and I'll work with Mr. Bender to get you that put on those forms.
The other piece here that we have been instructed by the co-chairs to have included in the discussion is a discussion of performance measures and their relation to the Oregon benchmarks. And I'm wondering where that is in this presentation.
Well, when we discussed this with Mr. Bender, at least my understanding of our conversation is that we weren't a state agency. We didn't quite fit in the benchmarks per se. We do have performance measures, and those are the ones that I listed at the beginning of the educational section and that I've included in all the slides. Things like our GPA in the applicant pool, the MCAT and DCAT scores, the application test scores, the licensure rates. Those are the performance measures that we have for the educational program.
A piece that is virtually all of the state agencies' performance measures is a way to measure how complaints are being dealt with and dispensed with. Do you have any of that kind of data?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. The complaints.
They come to me.
Yeah. Usually our emails, and then he forwards them to us. I don't know. I'm trying to think of what kind of complaint.
Well, usually what we've dealt with is with complaints about quality of service or ethical type issues, the amount of time it takes to deal with those kinds of issues, how they're dealt with, those kinds of general things.
Yeah, that wasn't on the sheet that I was given. I'll be happy to respond to it and bring it back in a report in a day or two. With that.
Okay, well, let's have a little conversation about, well, I don't want to have you turn your agent or your business inside out and upside down to try to come up with these things, so let's discuss that.
Yeah, that would be very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Looking like you have a comment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, along those lines, OHSU commonly surveys physicians and how we feel about the services you're rendering to us. So my guess is you've got that data just didn't realize it.
We certainly have lots of survey data. Complaints is what threw me, but we have a lot of survey data, both of patients, of referring physicians, of graduates, of course, outcomes data that we collect for accreditation. I mean, we have that sort of data. I'll talk to you afterwards and see what you would like us
to
bring.
Let's do that. Dr. Kohler.
Yes, let me, by the way, I'm not being too facetious about the complaints. All come to me, and we do have a mechanism to send them to the right place. If it's a clinical complaint, it's dealt with by the clinical systems. There are very few academic complaints per se. There's an occasional student who will complain, but that goes to the academic side of the program. I wanted to return to the Oregon opportunity because I think that's a critical question that you may be asked to answer later in the bonding and the value that it will have for the state and for OHSU, and just go through a few points there. I think that a couple things have happened to us that have really made the big difference. One was the public corporation that was approved by the legislature in 1995, generated from the legislature. I think the Oregon Opportunity gives us another chance to move forward for the state. The ability to go forward with the Oregon Opportunity is really based on where we are right now, and I think our value largely relates in many ways to the capital expenditures that have been made at OHSU, the improvement of our physical plant, and the faculty going hand in hand. You can see from this slide here that they're quite substantial. The Oregon Opportunity Program contains a number of components that are shown here. I'm not going to go through them, but to mention two in particular that I think are quite important. First of all, the biomedical research facility, which you see here, which is the basis on which we're doing much of our recruitment. We're promising people space in this new building. Now, as this building was put together, and after you passed the Oregon Opportunity in the legislature, and as a matter of fact, after it passed the public vote, it was tackled by the treasurer's office and the legal department there, and they decided that the Oregon Opportunity funds per se, the general obligation funds, could not be used directly to support the construction of this building. That the reason for that was that within that building would be NIH-supported activities, which might be commercializable, which is in fact what we want them to be, and that therefore that might jeopardize the tax-exempt status of the bonds. So what we did, and this was done with the legal department that the Attorney General's people assigned to the Treasurer's office, is put together our own revenue bond plan that would build the clinical tower that is necessary, as a matter of fact, to fund the ongoing operation. It is, if you look at it, our major revenue opportunity. And to use these bonds in such a way that both buildings were constructed. But the revenue bonding went forward with the pro formas indicating that there would be general obligation bonds from the state behind this overall operation. Everybody understood what was going on. There was no sleight of hand there. But as a result, we were going to end up with two buildings. One would build out the research capacity per se. The second would be the clinical tower, which would generate revenue in such a way that could pay off these problems. I think this is a very critical point, and one that's probably not well understood, but if you look at what the patient tower expansion contains, you'll see there this is a fairly large project, but one that we believe, handled appropriately, can allow us to carry out both our mission on patient care for people less able to achieve care, but also to bring in enough paying patients, commercial patients, to carry these two projects. Now, there are a lot of other things in here that are perhaps not known to people at large. We do, for example, we did partially fund a laboratory which is on the Eastern Oregon University campus, a new science building there in which we will put various activities, and the statewide clinical research project, which we think provides both a way to bring rural practitioners into our family with regard to the teaching activity they already do, but also research. This would be funded research. These practice networks are very popular right now with the National Institutes of Health because they answer important clinical problems, not in the academic center where there's a sort of an artificiality in a way to the intensity of care, but to problems confronting the practitioner in the rural area. For example, what does this new genetic testing mean to a guy in family practice in Burns? How do they even decide what's relevant and what's not in their particular practice? So that is the type of component of the rural, of the Oregon Opportunity that, again, may not be well recognized, and Dr. Halleck has mentioned already the Heron Network that supports that. Yeah. Now, the recruitment of faculty members is really a key issue to us, and we have been proceeding onward with this recruitment with the expectation that this would go forward. And I'll have to say, recruiting star academicians is a little bit like a coach recruiting athletes. There's one very, very important difference, though. Now, I take this, I don't know if you followed the story of the quarterback who was recruited by Rick Neuheisel to Colorado and then followed Neuheisel to University of Washington and never did play first string. But his point was sometimes coaches tell you things to recruit you that may not turn out to be true. I was actually a high school athlete myself, and I was recruited. Fortunately, I never had to climb Heartbreak Hill over and over like some of the less successful scholarship athletes did. But it's very, very important that we honor our commitments to people we're recruiting. We must follow through on our promises to them. That's very important. And I think if we are not able to do that, we are literally dead in the water with regard to recruitment. The importance of this is these are people bringing their money to Oregon. They're bringing in literally millions of dollars per year, in excess of what the payment will be on the debt service, and far in excess of that. These people are portable. I mean, they can bring their money here. They can take their money to another state where there are facilities being constructed as well. So it's very critical to us that we allow these people to come here. We do recruit very well. It is a great state in which to live. We just signed up somebody yesterday. We signed up the new head of biomedical engineering, who's going to be coming here from Emory, bringing a large amount of grant support. He will be working with the OGI campus primarily in this new biomedical engineering program that is partially supported by the Murdoch Foundation, for example. But that's the kind of partnership we need to put together. We have listed a number of what we would call star athletes, people who, again, bring a great deal of money with them when they come. That helps the Oregon economy, as you can see. And I think that in terms of our research programs, the next bar graph represents the University of Washington and the inflection point at which there was a spinoff of tech companies. And you can see here that that tended to occur in the range of about $200 million per year to a greater degree. And again, we've mentioned to you that we're already doing that now, but we are at that point where we anticipate a great deal more in the way of commercial results. You've heard, for example, that that Bend from Patricia Smith the day before yesterday has quite a little community of biotechnology. Surprising for a place like Bend. By the way, no cluster there. Wasn't a university even there to begin with, but it did get started. We do feed them intellectual property in such a way that they work on that, and they work with us in ways that help us both in terms of the future. Now, the question is, what would a delay in the bond sales do, or what would cancellation of the bond sale do? It would be very, very devastating to us, as I have mentioned. I think one of the first things I worry about is honoring the commitment to recruits that we've already made in expectation of this being here. I asked Mark Van Buskirk, who is our director of facilities, to sort of give me a thumbnail of how would we do if this delay were delayed or not funded. His view is that we can't carry out the construction projects that we have planned if we don't do that, if we don't have the full $200 million. It's been the basis of our pro formas. It has been sold to our bond funders, Wall Street, and donors. There are a number of people who have contributed specifically to go into a building. If there's no building, they'll not be able to do that. On the positive side of what this will do, I think Representative Bates asked about, you know, how's this going to help us on income tax and so forth. And I asked, you know, let's get a little more specific about what kind of people will this help. If you look just at the hard hats involved in direct construction, there will be about a total of a little over 2 million hours. This will include 200 steel erectors, 350 electricians, 360 plumbers, 340 HVAC installers, roofers, masons, and so forth, on and on. They will be expected to themselves be involved with about $57 million worth of payment for the trades. At 9% income tax or some part thereof, that will yield about $5 million, excess of $5 million. Other workers who will be involved in this construction, designers, fabricators, contract people, and so forth, another $59 million and about another $5 million overall in terms of income tax benefit from that. So that's directly, without any leveraging, we're looking at about $10 million worth of tax income tax revenue from the construction work ongoing there. And I don't have to tell you that it would be very good to have construction, more construction going on in the state. We have signed contracts. We have letters of intent. We have program pledges, recruits, donors that we all are expecting to deliver. And as a result, we have what are called sunk costs. These are costs that we have already spent and that range, you can see here, they vary, but they're in the range of $30 to $50 million, depending on what part of them you're looking at. These would, in theory, be lost if this were not to go forward. So I think that I'd like to say that our belief is that this will really advance the state, that it will be something that will be very important to our ability to take care of ourselves and all the mission that we provide that you, I hope, prize, and we do as well. That includes taking care of the less fortunate. That certainly includes building an employment base. It also means building out an industry that has been underrepresented in the state so far, and I think this is our shot to be able to do that. So I guess I'm saying that I hope that I can convince you that just as I'm honoring my commitments to people that we're recruiting, I hope we can believe the state will stand behind the commitment it has made already to fund the Oregon Opportunity and allow us to demonstrate to you that we can make this work and be of great value to the state. So I'd be glad to answer questions on how we got there, but I think this is a very important component of what we do. We are looking more and more like a private institution all the time. The state is giving us, again, about 4.3% of our budget directly and then indirectly through the Medicaid and Medicaid program and the federal government through Medicare. We think we've put together literally a $1 billion program based on trying to put the funding streams together in such a way that we can carry forward this mission. But we are in a partnership with the state. Unless you want to totally privatize us and see if we can survive that, I think we have been of great value. Hopefully you believe that as well and that we can move this program forward. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Questions or comments?
Just
you can't let this slide.
Oh, I can't. I can't. President Kohler, thank you for bringing this issue up again. I think the Oregon Opportunity is something this state cannot afford to pass up on. I think even short term, the money generated from income tax will pay for the bond issue, and delaying it is, I would think, the wrong direction to go for the state. We'll be sending ourselves deeper into recession instead of building ourselves out of it. I'm frankly surprised that John Hopkins is still talking to you.
Did you notice there's another recruit?
Yeah,
there,
I noticed that.
Another several million dollars worth of grant support that we also recruited.
Haven't been involved peripherally in these kind of recruitment wars. I'm surprised as tall as you still are and still standing there. But to be able to recruit these kind of people this quickly is absolutely amazing to me, especially when you haven't got the facility completed yet. I don't know where you're stacking these people. But they're going to bring in millions of dollars of grant money, which in turn will go into our economy. And I congratulate you for that. And I would tell you that many of us are strongly in favor of finishing the bond issue and getting that building built and bringing those people in and revitalizing our economy here in the state. Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope this wasn't covered when I was out and I'm being redundant, but I know a lot of the departments are being asked to look, and a lot of the state money recipients, since you're no longer a department, are being asked to look at some pretty severe cut levels. Have you, at the most severe, have you kind of thought about what your response would be? What would you have to do?
You want me to take that? Or you want to take
it? Go ahead.
It depends on what you mean by most severe. At the 30% level, which was the most severe scenario, we would look at, realistically, we would have to ask the dental school to be self-sustaining. Could it be? That is a very good question. The closures that have occurred around the country have all been in the private sector. It would require raising an element of private funding that is far and above anything we've been able to raise for any program. So, frankly, we don't think that's a very viable option. It's an incredible transition that you have to make, because we would have to phase it out over 4 years to honor the students who are here, and that's a legal obligation that we have, and there are very large costs associated with that, and you can't reverse it without an enormous investment. So it would be a very serious decision to have to do something like that.
Thank you.
I might just add,
we have requested that the Health and Sciences University work with LFO to put their mission and their cuts into the format that we've been requesting from the agency, so that we can work with it on a kind of a lateral way too.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. Could I add that on the current cut level that we're trying to achieve, which is to bring, again, the academic programs to a zero balance, we are already asking departments, for example, to cut a fairly large amount of money out of their programs. We're asking one department, for example, to cut $400,000 a year out of their program, and actually ask them to hire somebody else at the same time. So it makes it hard in managing that. There are ways to do it that will work to a degree, but there will be some pain involved in it.
At some point, you run out of room.
Yes.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments?
Madam Chair, just one last question.
Please bear in mind that we have several people signed up for public testimony.
Then I'll ask in private.
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate you taking time from your busy schedules to come and talk to us. We'll open now the public testimony piece of this, and I would ask Flo and Alexis Steinfeld to come forward. We have a long and honored tradition in this process of mispronouncing people's names, so please forgive us in advance for doing that. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Alexis Steinfeld. I'm Florence Steinfeld. We came to Doernbecher, actually, in 99. Alexis was diagnosed at that time with an inoperable brain tumor. It turned out to be one that no doctor in the world had seen in her part of the brain. They gave us grim possibility that she would live 6 months. At that time, the doctors went to work and came up with a protocol through their research to put her through radiation and chemo. She's here today only because of Doernbecher's diligence and hard work to make sure that this little girl did not become a statistic. They could have gone back and said, no, we can't do anything, because she was just one and the only one. She went through radiation. She went through chemo. Through radiation, she had something called necrosis, which does damage to the body and the brain. She was diagnosed this year with mental retardation because of the radiation. Again, she is in a program up there at Doernbecher in their research program to help her through learning so that she can go on in school as far as possible. They're helping her through a cognitive program with memorization and also working with her school and her teachers. She's come a long way. They thought that she would never walk. She thought that she would never be out of a wheelchair. She does walk with the help of a walker at times. She does talk. They never thought she would talk or see. She sees. She talks. She's a normal little girl that gives her little brother a hard time. She's a love, and it's only with the help of Doernbecher and their research that she's here today. And I hope that you find it in your hearts to give them the funding that they need so that more little girls and little boys are able to grow up and give their parents trouble and give their parents the love and that they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you very much for being so patient in waiting while we
Oh, she was patient.
And your baby is a true miracle.
She is.
I will call forward now Aaron Bissonette and Miriam Hugh and Jim and Linda Figursky. If you have written testimony, Mr. Bender would be glad to distribute it for you. I'm going to regrettably have to limit your testimony to about 3 minutes so that we can fit everyone in.
That's fine.
Please proceed.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Madam Chair Morgan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Bissonette, and I am a dental student at Oregon Health Sciences University. I'm also involved in the All Hill Council, which is the student government up there that represents all the different schools.
Could you put the microphone closer?
Sure. Is that better? Okay. I wanted to take this chance to say that I support the OHSU budget and appreciate all of the support the state has given OHSU, making it possible for me to obtain my degree in dentistry. The money that the state gives OHSU goes to support many great programs, which we have talked about for most of this morning, including dental, medicine, nursing, allied health professions, and biomedical research. Every cut in the state funding for OHSU directly relates to students that are served through these programs and the programs that are offered. And I just want to take a quick second to tell you guys about the importance of the dental school to myself and to the people across the state. I've always been passionate about providing dental care for those who are unable to access or afford care. It's not well known, but about 50% of Americans do not have the means to go to a dentist on a regular basis. Growing up, I thought all kids were able to get their teeth cleaned and cavities filled. In my first year in dental school, I realized how wrong a perception this is. Many of the children who come to the dental school have a significant health risk, rampant decay in their teeth. And thanks to your support, these kids are able to have access to dental care through OHSU, and I am able to have my dream job of helping these children. It's not only kids who benefit from the OHSU Dental Clinic, but we are able to provide care to many Oregonians who do not otherwise have access to dental care. For OHSU to continue to support these children and to provide educational programs that train the dentists to help them, state support is necessary. Thank you so much for supporting the dental program, and I hope that you're able to continue the support in these difficult budget times. And then the last thing I just wanted to say is I think that dental education is affordable just because I think being able to be a healthcare provider is pretty much priceless. But the $8,000 in tuition, the cost to be a dental student is a little more than that because we have to buy all our own equipment. Like, I don't know the fee each year because it goes up, but I just got my bill for next quarter, and we pay four times a year, and it was $6,000 just for the quarter because we have to buy all our own equipment. But like I said, I still think it's affordable, but I just wanted the numbers to be kind of accurate for what it costs the average student. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Figursky.
My name is Miriam Allo, and I'm here on behalf of Jim and Linda Figursky. I'm reading their letter because neither of them can be here.
Because we all have copies of this letter, it really isn't necessary to read it to us. This will become part of the record, and we will also read it as individuals. Did you want to kind of recap what's in here?
This letter opposes House Bill 5042 for a number of reasons. One of them is that many of the research that is going on is redundant. And I will cite one example. This is an experiment being done with NIH grants, and at HOSU, and it's Elliot Spindle's project titled Effects of Prenatal Exposure to Nicotine on Primate Lung Development. This project was initially funded on May 1st, 1978, and it's slated to receive funds through April 30th, 2004. Clearly, we know, because of the tobacco settlement, which is in itself a testimony, that smoking causes diseases and kills people. But these experiments are still going on. And that there we have a problem with the allocation of public funds going for this kind of research when so much is necessary right now. I mean, for instance, the School of Dentistry, talking about closing that. The point is that the tobacco settlement money should really be going where it was intended, either to help stop smoking, and it should be going in this critical budgetary times to needed public programs rather than using public money as venture capital in a very risky gamble that promises jobs and high returns. I think people really need, our elective representatives really need to look very hard into the facts of what this biotechnology gamble is about.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate Thank you.
Coming today and testifying to us. Chair calls Matt Russell and Josie Cheney. And once again, if you have something for the committee, Mr. Bender would be glad to take it. Please proceed.
Madam Chair Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Matt Rosell, and I'm here today representing In Defense of Animals, a national nonprofit welfare group for animals, and also representing myself as an Oregon taxpayer. Thank you for allowing this opportunity for public comment on HB 5042. I'm asking Madam Chair Morgan and members of the committee to move this bill out of committee with a recommendation to pass the funding for state support of OHSU's educational, clinical, and programs with the CDRC, but to recommend the legislature consider cutting the entire remaining budget of $106.3 million for the Oregon Opportunity Programs investment, and I'm going to explain our position. We do not believe the state's investment into infrastructure for biotech to be a sound use of these public dollars, especially in light of the current budget crisis with many public services at risk. According to OHSU's own Dr. William New Jr., hired as an expert in the field of biotechnology, OHSU officials are suffering from, quote, delusions of national grandeur in trying to establish Oregon as a major biotechnology research center. This is in an article that you're getting right now from the Portland Tribune biotech leader Futurist Tools on January 24 of 2003. New also said that that Oregon is 20 to 25 years behind other leading biotechnology centers. This feeling is supported by others, including Joe Courtwright, who was the former chief economic development staff person for the Oregon legislature, who compiled a report for the Washington, D.C.'s Brookings Institution entitled Signs of Life, the Growth of Biotechnology Centers in the U.S.
Mr. Rosell, with great respect, we can read this faster than you can say it. So if you would be so kind as to just kind of recap it for us.
Okay. Well, I want to tell you that the information in this is coming from a cover story in Brainstorm Northwest, January 2003. And to save paper, because it was such a big article, I have emailed you all this morning a link to that article, and I really would appreciate if you would take a look at that.
We appreciate you doing that.
What Courtwright says in a nutshell is that If you're not one of the nine largest cities in the country, that you can't really play in this biotech game. And I spoke with him on the phone, and he wasn't able to come down here today to testify, but he did say that he would be open to any of the legislatures giving him a call and getting his position on this. He is, you know, an expert in this area after doing this report. The article is very informative. The most important source of startup capital for biotech is venture capital. And so if OHSU's plan is to develop biotech here is viable, which a lot of these sources are saying it's not viable, but if it is truly viable, as OHSU is telling us, then because venture capital is how most of this biotech works, that it should be able to stand on its own merit. And I just want to say that it would be grossly understating the fact to say that the $94 million first installment of the Oregon Opportunity Money was a very generous contribution from the Oregon taxpayer to prime the biotech plan. So what we're suggesting is that now it's time to let the private sector take over. This goes on to talk about Ralph Shaw, who's another local venture capitalist who is quoted in this article as having serious concerns. And he says that we're talking about putting our entire seed capital and bonding rating, our ability to service debt, on economic numbers that don't support it. The cost of being wrong could be high. And he goes on to say, in order to get the funding promises were so far from right in his interpretation of reality that he was shocked that people didn't question these promises. So I urge you to take pause, look at the facts, listen to the economic voices of dissent, and rethink this decision to give away the remaining $103.6 million of bond proceeds to a potentially fatally flawed Oregon Opportunity Program that will not pay off with the economic boon OHSU promises. Oregonians deserve a thoughtful decision based on facts from non-biased experts, not just OHSU and others with vested interests. Especially during this difficult budget crisis, Oregon's legislators should spend this public money where it best benefits the public. The Oregon Health Plan, public schools, feeding Oregon's hungry, smoking cessation, education, or other uses for which the tobacco settlement money was actually envisioned. And I guess I want to leave you with a question. Are the members of this committee willing to take a good, hard, second look at the Oregon opportunity with an eye towards pulling this public money back into the tobacco settlement account to meet these public needs?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Cheney.
Yes, my name is Josie Cheney, and I'm a citizen of Multnomah County, representing myself.
You can hold that microphone towards you so you don't have to lower it back coming out of this.
I'm not a very good public speaker, but there are 7 points I'd like to make today regarding the Oregon Opportunity Plan. The first point is the misconception that it was something that was approved by voters. In 2001, there were two measures to give up to $10 million to the Oregon Health Sciences University, and both of them were voted down. Then in the following year, the legislature is the one that approved 10 times that amount to OHSU, and the only thing that the voters approved was paying less to do that via Measure 11 to create the exception in the Constitution for the backing by general obligation bonds instead of the tobacco tax settlement bonds. I would like to state that I was inspired by Mrs. Seinfeld's story and Alexis. However, I really would like to see that happen for more children, not less, and I see that happening as we spend money on expansion of biotech as opposed to human services like prevention and basic medical care that actually treat a lot of the conditions we're supposedly studying at OHSU. I'd like to point out that those services also need buildings that require construction companies and workers and create revenue and create income taxes. They also have staff, the same as a biomedical research facility does. This is not our only opportunity to create good jobs. Things like the dental school should be one of the last things that are cut. It's providing a valuable service. I believe that clinical and service-based answers are the answer right now in this time of desperate need for people. I would say that the $10 million in income tax that they project coming in from researchers coming to the state pales in comparison to our $200 million investment. I don't know how much of that investment and its returns will be actually coming back to Oregonians. It sounds like a lot of it will be going to private investment, and it's difficult to estimate how much of it will actually get back to the public that paid for it. I believe that public investment should end up as public profit. And I would lastly point out that not honoring obligations to researchers who have agreed to come to this yet unbuilt facility pales in comparison to not honoring our obligations to Oregonians who are suffering, and some of them are dying.
Thank you. You did a great job in your testimony. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk to us today. Chair calls Ralph Groner and Melissa Unger.
Excuse me, Melissa.
Melissa, do you have a handout for the committee? Steve. Please proceed, Mr. Groner.
Thank you so very much, Madam Chair, and I will stick to my 3 minutes. My name is Ralph Groner. I represent AskMe, and we have 150 locals in Oregon. OHSU happens to be our largest local with nearing 6,000 members and growing. So I'm here to speak not only for my members, but hopefully for the state of Oregon. I'll do mine quickly. I just want to say that the voters overwhelmingly supported the use of general obligation bonds to move the bioresearch center at OHSU. I've heard Mr. Shaw. I like his name's Ralph. I've listened to him testify here, and I shake his hand. But I would like to say, although I'm an economist as well out of the U of O, that my background suggests if we can't plan the biotech game, I'd like to know what OHSU has become famous for and how many lives have been saved by OHSU in the world of cancer research already, in the work of they did with my sister, who was in Dornbecker for 7 years, and we didn't have a penny. My father was in the logging industry, and my entire family grew up in the mills, and we had accidents in our family. My sister today is in the State Department and very successful as a result of OHSU. So I'll only bring that into the record to say they have a wonderful continuum, and their continuum goes from everything from, I drew it out in my head to get this done in 3 minutes, economic development, 11,500 employees throughout Oregon. However, they create 42,500 jobs with a $1 billion budget. They create $2.3 billion in the economy in this state. Construction, that does not include the construction that will be built and create 5,000 construction, family wage, that's big to unions, jobs with benefits because of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And it is Portland's largest employer, but it's also the fourth largest in public employer in this state. Senate Bill 2, some of you helped us with. Senator Messerly, I can't recall if all of you were here on the House side or not, and I apologize, that made us a public corporation, and that we have spread our wings and grown. But what that really means economically is OHSU is really, to me at least, the shining star of economic development in Oregon. I really cover revenue more than I do budgets, and one of the things that I look at tax expenditures through the 30 years since serving on the Revenue Committee many years ago, is the promise that we'll create new jobs by industry after industry. And most of those lobbyists are my friends. Some do, some don't. OHSU does not have to promise. I only want to say to you the facts are there. They have delivered, and their jobs do not go overseas for lower wages and no benefits. They remain in Oregon. where they are family wage jobs, continuing to create more jobs and to stimulate Oregon's economy. So I would say that any investment that can be put in OHSU is a proven track record from an economic development standpoint. Education, everything from dentistry, nursing, you know all of that, but it is a major school. Our education program is highly regarded throughout the nation, as in research. I hate to differ with anyone who testifies here that are hundreds and hundreds of breakthroughs in research at OHSU. It's interesting the nation knows about them if Oregonians don't. I happen to read all of those articles in every one of the magazines, and I can tell you that Oregon's research out of OHSU is already on a proven, highly renowned track record, and quite frankly, it was no wonder Oregonians overwhelmingly supported the Oregon opportunity, because they could trust them. And last, our hospitals treat the mentally ill, kids, dental, etc. The only comment I want to make, we cut, and thank you for the briefing, the Oregon Health Plan. We, 41% of our clients, as you probably know, at OHSU are Medicaid eligible. We continue to cut, I realize we have to, the health plan. But we can't cut, in my opinion, at both ends. The hospital that treats more than any other hospital in this state is OHSU. So there has to be a safety valve, and I appreciate this opportunity. I welcome this opportunity, and I appreciate the wonderful job you're all doing under terrible circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. Ms. Unger.
Good morning, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. I'm Melissa Unger, and I am the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association represents students at all seven public universities, Lane Community College, and also the Oregon Health and Science University. And so today I just want to support their budget. I'll make this short. One of the most important pieces of the state funding that comes is to the educational programs. And you heard the student from the dental school and the prospects of major cuts to the OHSU budget and what that will do to the different programs. And we just want to support the students in the programs at these schools and say that we understand that you're in a difficult position looking at the budget situation and that you're doing all you can to minimize cuts. But it's very critical that these educational programs exist in Oregon, and it's one of the only two dental schools in a lot of these western states. And so it provides a critical service to Oregon and also provides a critical service to a lot of other students in other states. And so we want to firmly support the money that goes to the educational programs, the nursing programs, the medicine programs, the allied health programs. And that's really important. And then we also just want to be on record supporting the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. We believe that this is a very important program for Oregon. It will bring in jobs. It will bring in a developing new industry. And OHSU students support it. We support it very strongly. And so we just encourage you to do all you can to make sure that you maintain funding for these educational programs and also the continued support for the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We close the public hearing on House Bill 5042. Mr. Bender, do we have any housekeeping issues we need to take up?
No, Madam Chair, just to note that we have distributed some more written testimony from people who were not able to come, and you want to look at it.
Thank you. And having no further business before the committee today, the meeting is adjourned, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.